Okay, are we ready again? Pretty much everybody's staggered back in. Here's an example Cairo application, our lovely free desktop clock. One of the nice things you can see about this lovely clock is that it's sucking the hell out of my machine. This is currently consuming 92% of the CPU. Draw our lovely clock here. Actually, it's consuming 100%. You notice that it's not actually keeping up with the time smoothly. And I had to turn the compositing manager off because that sucks even more. Actually, if I do this, if I do... that looks a little better, and it'll run a little faster. So is that actually usable now? Barely. Gives you some idea of the kinds of applications we're hoping to be able to use Cairo with. You can notice the shadows are smooth, are drawn, blended over the background. And here in the center where the shadows all join, you'll notice they're correctly drawn so that the shadows aren't drawn multiple times. So you get a reasonably accurate representation. Obviously, everything is nicely subpixel rendered because the second hand can move smoothly, and you don't notice any obvious pixels on the screen. Looks pretty good today. So that's the target we're after here. And of course, if you resize this application down to, oops, missed. No, I could use the mouse. I cut the mouse out for a reason. You resize it down really small, and you can still make out pretty much all the detail in it, including all the little tick marks for the minutes around. And if I did that with without any aliasing or subpixel coordinates, it would really look ugly. Yes. Yes, this doesn't require anything magic. In fact, I have the compositing manager turned off right now, so it's basically a generic X server. Yeah. What? Not on this server. No, this is pure, this is all software. And this is not a hard application to draw. This is just a lot of polygons. So the most expensive thing, of course, is drawing the shadow, because it actually blends the shadow in. So. And if you don't, and it's actually updating 10 times a second so that it draws smoothly and doesn't tick around. And it redraws the hands every tenth of a second so that the minute hand smoothly moves from 1 minute to the next, and the hour hand smoothly moves from 1 hour to the next. So, you know, this is
So,
yes, this is all drawn with the render extension. The mouse cursor is flickering because it's not flickering too badly now. Oh yeah, that's because the X server is about to draw. This is a software cursor, and without the compositing manager running, I have no way of double buffering the cursor onto the screen. And so the application draws the whole clock off screen and then blitz it onto the screen. And before it blitz it onto the screen, it has to remove the cursor, copy the contents, and put the cursor back on top. My intention is to double buffer that operation with a cursor, and so you paint the cursor into the source image, copy the source image to the screen, and then remove the cursor from the source image. That's my plan, to get rid of the flickering cursor. That should fix the problem. Unfortunately, with the way I changed the X server, it turns out to be a lot more work, and so I just haven't gotten it done yet. I've been doing other things. You know, the flickering cursor annoys the heck out of me, but I've somehow managed to live with it for many years. With a Radeon, you actually get hardware support for the ARGB cursors, so it doesn't flicker at all on that. Oh no, it's doing some incremental rendering, so it redraws everything. It redraws the damaged portions. No, it has to redraw the hour hand, the second hand, and all the shadows because they move slightly. And then it has to repaint the area that's affected underneath them. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now there are some optimizations that could be done here. Yeah, obviously. There's a lot of work to be done to optimize the system. When you actually have hardware compositing, the performance is a lot better. So that's you know, what you can do. Performance, as you can see, needs some work. It's actually quite usable for, you know, relatively static activities. I'll show you some more things like just drawing images. Oh, what happened? Oh! I had to kill update, so now my update database is empty. Never mind. I was going to show you some fun insect pictures to show you how fast they draw. I can show you those later when I can try to remember where they are. Hard disks are too big these days. We need to fix that problem. Or make all the files bigger. That's one of my big plans. What? Are we ready? Okay, so now I'm going to teach you how to use Cairo, and then I'll tell you how I built Cairo. So kind of two different steps. We got an hour and a half? Okay. So Cairo API will be a little shorter than it would have been if we had more time. I spent too much time in the first half. Okay, so I'm going to teach you how to construct paths, I'm going to teach you how to deal with images, and then I'm going to teach you how to draw some text. Pretty simple. Again, the examples that you see here on the screen are not cut pieces of code, but if you piece together the code in these slides, you actually get a complete, all the examples are complete. There's no elision of any kind necessary. That's because Cairo is a nice library. Okay, so how do you draw stuff to memory? Most all these images here, I dumped them out to disk so I can incorporate them into OpenOffice, because OpenOffice doesn't use Cairo yet. Relatively simple, you allocate a big pile of memory for your image, and then you basically say, oh, Cairo, please draw to memory. And so you create this image telling it where it is in memory and how big it is. And then you draw some figure to it and then call a function to write it out. This function, I don't have source for that here. It has to use the Ping library, which is kind of hard. X is harder to draw to, oddly. You have to open the display, and then you get to create a simple window. That only takes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like a dozen arguments. Cool. The other one takes fewer arguments. One of them is a structure with about 50 values in it. So, Cairo, we strove for fewer arguments in our functions. Essentially, all you have to do is say, oh, Cairo, please draw to this X object. And for GL, again, there's another function that says, oh, Cairo, please draw to this GL object. Relatively simple. So the only thing that's relevant here, this code here, this draw function that I'm calling here, I'm pointing to my screen. That's very helpful for you. This draw function here is the same. It takes the same Cairo state. So we can tell that it's output device independent, because you can either draw to the screen or draw to a ping file. If you draw to ping, you draw to anything. Okay, so how do you build paths? Well, it looks a lot like PostScript. You can move, you can draw lines, you can draw curves, you can also draw arc too, which is a circle instead of a bezier. And then you can close it, and that links up the front and the back of the path. You can also build paths from glyphs or texts using text path and glyph path. And when I did this tutorial last September, these weren't implemented, but now they are. So I have some examples of those, and that's fun. And the other thing that PostScript does is it has this stack of states. And so you can basically say, okay, I'm going to mutate the state. I'm going to do some transformations and set some parameters and change colors and stuff. But I want to be able to get back to where I was without having to think about how to restore it. So you just save the state, do a bunch of manipulation, and then restore. So it gives you this nice nested model. So basically, you can, if you want to like tile a screen with an SVG or a little Cairo image, you can just save your state, do a transform, paint the object, restore your state, save your state again, do another transform, and just iteratively call the same code without having to pass a bunch of parameters around. Yeah, of course. Limited by VM. the error stuff, I'm going to show you how all the error stuff works. I got kudos from many people for my error handling, including some guy who wore a penguin suit here last week. Yeah. So I patted myself on the back for that design. That was my idea. Most of the stuff was implemented just by taking the PostScript manual and writing a bunch of C code, which is kind of cool. It's like, ooh, somebody else did all our design for us. That's very nice. So it can't be wrong. Actually, it is kind of interesting. We read through the PostScript manual, and we started implementing Cairo, and it was really nice. Most of the time, it was like, oh, yeah, the PostScript idea really is the right idea. They really had a lot of good ideas in that design. So we were able to use it without a lot of modification. We changed a few names where we thought their names were really poorly chosen, but most of the time we used their names directly. So if you've written PostScript output and you look at the PostScript manual and the Cairo stuff, we intentionally used a lot of the same names as much as possible. When you've got a path constructed, you've got all these splines and lines all glued together, you can do three things with it. You can stroke it, which is to draw a line along the path, and that's the hardest for us. You can fill it, which is just to paint the interior of the path. Or you can clip it, which is to say you basically render the path to an alpha mask and use that alpha mask to clip all of your future drawing. And that's exactly how it's implemented inside, which means that you get any aliased edges and all that kind of nice stuff. So the other thing you can do is you can take the path and convert it to a stroke version. So you can take your path, which is, you know, like this, and you can actually convert it so you get a path that follows the outside of your stroke. We don't have a name for that yet. The PostScript name is really awful. And we really can't stand it, but we may end up using it anyhow. I don't remember what it's like, stroke path or something? I don't remember what it is. I don't recall. In any case, we'll have something that does that. But that's actually really hard to do in any sensible way. And you end up just basically tessellating the whole path, and so you end up with a bunch of line segments on the outside. So it depends upon the output device to keep the resolution so you scale it and transform it and bad things happen. We don't know what to do with that yet. Okay, so how do you use this stuff? Pretty simple. All these functions, this little basket function, this would be called draw from that other code. So if you call this function draw and drop it into that C code that had the ping output and just do this, this is what you get on the output. You get a lovely move to here, we line to here, and we curve to here, and you'll note, haha, I get a ugly corner. Why is that? Well, I didn't close the figure. And so you don't close the figure, you get caps in both ends of the path, and the caps in this case are butt caps, and so you see kind of an ugly little turn right there. Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. How do you fix that? Well, I'm not going to tell you how to fix it yet. I'm going to tell you all the options you've got. The paths are all stroked with an elliptical pen. It's actually what it is, it's a circle in user space. So you specify the radius of the pen, and you get a circle. When you transform that to the output, to the affine transformation, you're getting an ellipse, some elliptical or rotated of some kind. And so everything is stroked with these ellipses, just like in PostScript. You get the usual three join styles and the usual cap styles. The join round just paints the cap at the end, paints the image of the pen at the end, which is pretty straightforward. So these are usual PostScripts. Nothing scary here. We have a miter limit specifiable. That's so that when you get really sharp, if you take two lines and you put them at a very acute angle and you draw a miter, it starts getting very, very long. And in fact, when they're coincident lines, the miter is infinitely long. And so what PostScript did is it said, okay, whenever the miter gets, you can set a limit so that whenever the miter gets to a certain length, it converts it to a bevel. So it doesn't get insanely long. It gets a well-defined behavior to the system. That means you go like this, and it goes, and then all of a sudden it disappears entirely. So it's kind of funky looking when you're animating it. But PostScript wasn't for animation, so it didn't matter to them. So we let you set the limit, but... What? Oh, yeah, well, there's display PostScript. Nobody uses that, so it doesn't matter. That's a bad idea. Okay, and the usual cap styles. Okay, so here is the completed stroke example with the draw function. It sets the line with the 8. Oh, I didn't tell you about the lovely Cairo default transformation matrix. Now, I got a question about that last week in the email list. I better tell you about it. In PostScript, one in the default transformation, one unit is one point on the screen. So if you draw a one-width line, the line is 1 point wide. So at 300 dpi, it's about 4 pixels. Four and a half pixels, something like that. And at 100 dpi, it's 1.5 pixels, 1.25 pixels. We decided that by default, we really didn't want to be drawing fuzzy lines all over the screen, because in 2D graphics, again, images are largely static, and you want to make things look relatively sharp on the screen. So what we've done is kind of a kludge, well, kind of a cute hack, I suppose. The default transformation is set up so that you get about 1/100 of an inch for the default transformation, about. And it rounds that to the nearest whole number of pixels. So if you're on a 100 dpi screen, you get 1 pixel wide for the default transformation. And if you're on a 200 dpi screen, you get 2 pixels wide in the default transformation. And that's so that everything looks relatively sharp and you get these big jumps in the default transformation instead of this infinite continuous blurriness on the screen. It's kind of confusing. You get at 75 dpi rounds up to one pixel. Yeah. So, you know, as you know, 51 dpi to 149 dpi or something, you get 1 pixel, and so it rounds to the nearest whole number of pixels. And on paper, we don't do that. PostScript, it's just on the screen. And that works. That does everything. So that means that your text, all of your text sizes, are rounded to this logical DPI. So everything kind of works out okay. Okay, and you stroke it. Very nice. Okay, again, the ugly corner. How do you fix the ugly corner? We close the path with close path, just like in PostScript. It draws a line if necessary. In this case, it's not because they're already coincident. And it joins instead of tapping the two things. So you get the lovely sharp corner there in the corner. So it's exactly the same, except move to, line to, curve to, join, close. So you get the lovely join. Okay, so what kind of, wait a minute. All right, this slide looks redundant. And you use the Cairo set line cap and Cairo set line join. SVG uses different names for these. Line cap style and line join style. I don't remember the SVG names. They're always confusing me. Why did they pick a new name when PostScript already had picked a name? They decided to go their own way, traveling the road less traveled. Okay. I wanted to show you some examples of how the capping and joining works. So I have this lovely example here that sets up. Yeah, great. There's a lot of Cairo code here. Oh, there's the closing curly brace, so you know that we're done here. It's going to set a line cap and a line join, set a line width. It draws, I'll show you what they look like. Here's what they look like. It shows you the three different styles. Here's the butt with a miter, round with a round, and projecting a square with a miter. This is butt with a bevel, yeah. And so this thing actually draws two lines, the inside line and the outside line. So you can actually see where the path is in relation to the stroking. And I just made this really big, so I magnified it by a factor of 50. So when I drew those little one-by-one lines, they would get really big, which is kind of fun. And then I pushed them over a ways so you could see them. Okay. Let's see, what are we doing here? Filling paths. Okay, so that was a stroking path. Now you also want to be able to fill the path. So it closes the path. So when you fill the path, it always has to close it, because it kind of needs to know what's inside and what's not inside. So it closes it with a line if necessary, and then fills the interior. And has the usual winding rules. I don't know why even odd exists, but it does. It is a lot more efficient to implement. Here's our lovely filled example. It's just the same path, and now it's got it's filled with this lovely red color. This is this red color, the official Cairo red color, which is really hideous in almost any media. Designed on purpose that way. We did this logo at about 4:30 in the morning before the first Cairo presentation. We were a little, we were doing great. We had about 3 hours before the talk to be, was to be given, and we knew we had enough time. We hadn't slept for about 3 days. And we chose this lovely red color, as you can see. Let's see. Fill in stroke. The nice thing is that the save and restore actually saves and restores a path. In PostScript, when you fill or stroke something, it actually throws away the current path, because most of the time you want to do that. Most of the time you don't want to save the path, because you want to start a new path, draw something else. You don't want to have some explicit operation to throw it away. So the only way to save and preserve the path is to use the save and restore, because save and restore saves and restores everything, including the path. Could just draw it twice, but you know, I got to show you save and restore. So, what? Yeah, we don't do those. And the reason for that is that we don't really need those because we have multiple contexts. Okay, so here again, we're gonna draw our basket, and that's just gonna create a path. It doesn't stroke it or fill it. It just puts the path structure in memory. And I'm gonna save, set it to red, and fill it. There's my red interior. I'm gonna restore. Oh, back to my path is now restored. I'm going to set it to black, set the line width to 8, and stroke it. So there's the resulting figure drawn there. And you can do that. You can do other cool stuff. And I'll show you the next example. We have affine transformations. We have rotations, translation, scale, and shear, and single matrix. We have functions just like PostScript does. You can say scale, or you can say translate, as you've seen already before. Those are really operations that construct a new matrix and multiply it into the current matrix, and that's how they're defined. We've kind of made the matrix a little bit abstract so that we might consider converting the matrix from a regular affine transformation to a projective transformation, except that explodes our spline. Well, I don't know what we're going to do. So it's kind of abstracted. You can't really see the matrix directly. There's some get and set abstract matrix objects. There aren't any non-projective transformations. The reason for that is, if you have a perspective transformation, you've seen those perspective pictures, the width of the line changes as you change in the perspective. And our algorithms don't handle that. So we adopted the PostScript model, which doesn't have those transformations. Transformations are cumulative. So translate and then scale is not the same as scale and translate. It's just like, you know, matrices aren't order independent, operation order independent. Okay, so here's our transformation example. I'm going to draw the basket, and then I'm going to translate by a ways down to the right. I'm going to rotate by 30 degrees. I'm going to make it half the size, and then I'm going to draw it again. And the interesting thing about this is that you'll note that this line here is not as thick as, come on, go, this line here. This line is twice as thick. And the reason for that is, come on, you can do it. Go open office. The reason for that is that the pen is constructed when you call stroke using the current transformation. So the fact that I drew this bigger basket before I did this scale, before I scaled by a factor of 2, is irrelevant to the width of the final stroke. So both of these get to use the same pen for the whole figure, even though one was drawn before the transformation. And that means that you can draw a complicated figure and then using some nested functions and then stroke the whole thing and everything comes out with the same width, which is often useful. If you want to do it with a different width, you stroke them independently. And that will work too. Here's the winding rule. Now I drew that figure so that they overlap so you can see the difference between the winding rules. They overlap slightly here. There's even odd where it counts some edges and there's winding, zero winding. Non-zero winding, rather. I don't know why people would like even odd, but it's part of every graphic standard. So we said, what the heck? It's free. We'll expose it. It's kind of like you're implementing a polygon filler, and you get your choice. Even odd, winding. Oh, the even odd and the winding is a little if statement. So we figured we might as well implement it and expose it to the poor user so that I could explain it in every tutorial I would give. Okay, one of the interesting things about Cairo, unlike PostScript, is that Cairo's memories, Cairo has as many surfaces as you want. So it's not just one. And the memory surfaces are just images. They're just block big chunks of memory. And what you can do is you can actually take one of those surfaces and paint it onto another surface. So you can do all your intermediate rendering. You can construct an image in memory and paint it onto another surface. When you do that, the image is actually transformed through the matrix. This particular operation doesn't have a projected transformation because it just uses the regular Chiro affine transformation matrix. There is a way to do projected transformations, and I'll show you those in a minute. So you can load an image file, just read the ping file, and again, after we've dumped the image into memory, just create a surface from it. And now I can use this surface with any drawable. I can use it PostScript, I can use it onto the screen, I can use it into another memory image. And because it goes through that transformation, because there's a default transformation matrix that makes it about 100 dpi, then the image, you can think of this image as being, if it's logically 100 dpi, which most images are these days, then it comes out about the right size in every output device, so there's less fussing to deal with. There's my daughter's little Cairn Terrier. You'll see him again. Pretty simple. You'll see this function was called dog surface. Now you know why. So you create the surface, and then you move to 0, 0 and show it. Pretty simple. You got to tell it where to put the image. And you can also transform it. There, I'm going to translate a ways and scale it and rotate it. And there we go. Lovely affine project. Now you note that because I did the scale by a non-square amount, and then I did the rotate, the image actually ended up sheared. That's just the order of operations. If I did those operations in reverse order, it would not be sheared. Pretty straightforward. Hey, my battery's almost charged. It's very exciting. We have two different resampling modes, nearest neighbor and bilinear. I should probably do some real filtering as well, because some people actually care what their images look like, unlike OpenGL people. So as you can see here in the bilinear interpolation mode, you can still see the square pixels. Can you see them at all, square pixels? Yeah, so bilinear interpolation doesn't actually do a reasonable filtering job to get rid of the square edges. So you can still see them, which is kind of a bummer. So I may add some real cubic filtering, I don't know. I don't know what I'll add. Oddly, the render extension has both of these modes. I know, it surprises and amazes you. You can pattern stuff. This is the only example I have. You can pattern anything. Of course, you can draw draw a path, and when you fill it, you can either fill it with a solid color, or you can fill it with another surface. So you can pattern stuff. Now the nice thing is the transformation matrix applied to the source pattern is a projective transformation matrix. So you can do anything you want with that. You can do all the affine transformations, and you can also do perspective transformations. And you can repeat them. What? Yes. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You could do the idea was to expose all the capabilities of the underlying hardware. And because the render extension can do this, no problem. So can Chiro. Oh, and maybe GDI Plus will have troubles. And patterns can repeat, so you can actually tile things. Here's a pretty simple one. Again, we create our dog surface, and then we just set the pattern. And that's a function essentially the same. You've seen me doing set RGB color. All that does is set a solid colored pattern. That's all that function does. So they're there is a default pattern, and there's a bunch of ways of setting it. You can set it to a solid color, or you can actually set it to an image. And then we can fill with it. Pretty simple. And now we can actually do pattern transformations. Each source surface, I'm not sure about this, where it should live. I'm not very happy with the way this works. And so you construct this transformation matrix with the operations. I don't remember if the current API has projected transformations or not. There's no reason it couldn't. And I think I added them. I don't remember. One of the real problems we're having, though, is with gradients. If you look at the PostScript specification or the PDS specification for gradients, it's amazing. In the current PostScript language reference, It has like six different kinds of gradients, all the way from simple linear gradients to these spline meshes with tensor mesh gradients that take, I don't know, like 50 parameters per little tensor patch. They're amazing. I don't know what to do with that kind of gradient stuff. I think probably what we may end up doing is providing kind of a procedural pattern where you give a C function or some maybe some built-in function, and the C function, you give it an arbitrary coordinate and it returns you an ARGB value. That may be our kind of our implementation of gradients. So you ask the function what the value is at a particular coordinate and it returns it to you so that the system can compute all the values that it needs in a procedural way. And that may be what we end up doing. And I think with procedural patterns, we can do all of the weird PostScript textures, all the weird PostScript gradients without going insane. So here's a lovely transformed pattern. We have these matrix objects. And again, I was almost certain I had projective transformations in there. I may be wrong. You construct the matrix, and then you set the surface matrix. And that seems funky, because the only place a surface matrix is used is if that surface is used as a pattern for another object. So I'm not real happy with how this works yet, and this may change. You'll notice that the image is clipped not only to the basket here, you can kind of see the outline of the basket here, it's also clipped to the image. And because we have alpha values, I have a pretty good definition for what the values are outside of these coarse image. They have zero alpha. If I didn't have alpha, I'd have to have some specification for those pixels. But I know they are. They are transparent. So that actually has worked out quite nicely. Okay. Gradients. Gradients are a mess. We don't have gradients in Java right now. And the intention is to expose them through the same patterning mechanism. We have set RGB color. We have set pattern. We'd like some set gradient, but we don't know how to do it yet. Right now, what we do, we have a lovely kludge. We use, remember, you can scale the pattern, right? So what we do is you build a pattern that has two colors in it, two pixels in it, like a dark blue one and a light blue one, and then you scale it up really big with a bilinear interpolation. Now you get a lovely gradient. Oh, okay. So we may do procedural patterns, or maybe may do triangular patches. We probably aren't going to do the tensor mesh from PostScript. That seemed like a mass overkill. PostScript has a different requirement. You need to be able to dump all this crap into the printer and have it resolution independent. So they have, sometimes they go into massive overkill mode, because the last thing they want to be doing is trying to have you implementing some complicated tensor mesh in PostScript, which is god-awful slow. We have the advantage of having a compiled language for all of our operations, so we may have some callback mechanism. But callbacks are evil, because callbacks introduce locking nightmare. So we don't know what to do. Suggestions are welcome. Let's see. So I'm going to show you how to do gradients in the current system, because I want you to all know how ugly it is. This is only half of the setup. Here you have a little, basically, draw pixel function. It sets an RGB color, draws a little square, and fills it. Very nice. So here I'm going to draw three different colors, red, green, and blue. And so I've got red, green, and blue in a lovely little, I guess it's horizontal in this case. So I've got this red, green, and blue, three little pixels drawn, the little squares. And now I'm going to create the gradient. I create a similar surface, a 3x2, can't be 3x1 because I have to scale both directions. And then I'm going to paint red, green, and blue rectangles in there, and then scale it so that it scales to fit the destination image, set it so it's bilinear interpolation so you get nice filtering, and then fill the gradient. Isn't that lovely? And look, oh, pretty gradients. But it actually does work. It's just kind of pathetically grim in terms of actually using it. So we don't know quite what to do. But that's what we do today. Is anybody else horrified by this? Two pages to set up a gradient? Yeah. Okay. Now, oddly, in 2D, we draw a lot of text. There we go. Okay. Okay, so in text, the main thing was to separate out the font selection from the actual text drawing. Right now, the only parts of the API they were exposing is this kind of this toy API. We wanted to get the infrastructure ready and be able to start using it to see whether we liked some of the data structures that we created. So we're exposing the toy API, and that means we can get it running on every system. Getting the real API is actually easier because we just expose some of the internals once we're happy with them. There was some argument in December over how the text transformation should work. Do we want a separate glyph transformation matrix? And that's gone away. We're going to do it just like PostScript because doing things different is wrong unless you have a really good reason, and there wasn't a really good reason. The argument was pretty simple. The question is, when you draw a glyph, what matrix do you use to position the glyph, and what matrix do you use to scale the glyph, to transform the glyph itself? PostScript just uses one matrix, and you draw everything along the baseline. But that means that if you want to draw things vertically, you have to constantly do move to. They're kind of a pain. So what we did instead is we said, okay, text comes in two kinds, horizontal and vertical. And so you can tell the system, oh, I'm interested in getting the vertical matrix for this font. Which, for many font, yeah. No. No, I'm actually talking about kanji, when you want to lay out Japanese text from top to bottom and not rotate the glyphs. When you want to rotate the glyphs and the baseline, that's easy. You all use the same matrix. But when you want to rotate, when you want to leave the glyphs upright and rotate the baseline, so PostScript doesn't allow you to do that. And so if you want to actually rotate the baseline, you actually have to do all your own computations as to where they should move to. And there's really only one legitimate use for that, and that's when you want to draw Han characters vertically instead of horizontally. And the problem is that when you want to space the characters like that, you don't want to use a horizontal escapement, because sometimes, Han characters are almost always square. But if the glyphs aren't square, you know, if they're taller than they are wide, you don't want to use the width of the glyph for vertical spacing. So you need to use the right spacing anyhow. So what you want to do is some fonts actually have horizontal spacing and vertical spacing. And that's how you're supposed to do it with the font. You're supposed to say, oh, font boy, I want you to give me the vertical escapements, not the horizontal ones. And if the font has them, you'll get the vertical ones. Otherwise, you get a bunch of zeros. And it tells you, that, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have those vertical metrics for you. And you have to figure them out on your own. Good luck. Have a good time. Oddly, yeah. Well, actually, no, remember, the real API doesn't exist yet. So that mechanism is all just abstract. That's how we're going to do it. But yeah, obviously, and when you create the font, that's all system dependent, because you have to talk to the operating system dependent font access to actually get a font object. So you have to tell the operating system whether you want vertical, horizontal metrics. Yep. Yes. Yeah, so if you're using GTK, you go through Pango, and that hides all the font system from you. And GTK already has Windows, Mac, I don't know if it has Mac OS X, Windows and X, Windows and font config, font handling. So this is easy for Pango. Well, they already have the code. It's not easy. But they already have the code, so I don't have to worry about it. So our current implementation only exposes this toy API for simple examples. That's because, again, we wanted to get the infrastructure ready, and we wanted to get most of the external API is stable, so we can figure out how the semantics of the system work without having to fuss over particular nitty-gritty details. Oh, did I go backwards? Crazy. The nitty-gritty details of how you expose font config and Windows fonts to the application. We replaced the API in the summer when we decided that we really had to have these two different levels. The toy API is very trivial, family weight and slant. It has no facilities for listing fonts. Listing is really hard, finding out what fonts are available. So we don't do that. So you hand me a family name and I promise that I will draw some characters on the screen. Yeah, you'll get some characters on the screen. Yeah. Maybe. If when you're lucky. The intention that I have in the Toy API, which hasn't been realized yet, is to actually do all the font substitution so that if you draw an arbitrary Unicode string, you'll get something for whatever glyph, for as many glyphs as possible. So then that's actually pretty easy to do. Yeah. Again, no facility for listing fonts. So if you want to find out what fonts are available, Kyra doesn't do that. For the full API, we just expose the native operating system font objects. So when you want to create a Kyra font object with the full API, you actually construct yourself an operating system dependent font object and hand it to Kyra and say, here's the font I want to use. So that means Kyra will have APIs for every operating system that take the native font object. Get type checking that way. Very nice. Strong type checking is good, right? Now, the reason for that is the application has to have access to that font object. So we had two possible ways of implementing this. We could implement an abstract font matching mechanism and a function that returns you the native font object. Oh boy, that would be useful. That would be one way. Or we could throw all that code away and say, fine, you give me the font, and now you've got the native operating system dependent font, and you've got a Kyra font, and we don't have a bunch of code in our system you didn't want to call anyhow. The reason you need the native font object is because every font object, oddly, has weird capabilities. In FreeType, Tango ends up opening the font to find all the OpenType tables, because FreeType doesn't provide APIs to get out all that information. In Windows, it does. So you can use Windows APIs to open up the get all the OpenType information for your Devanagari layout. And so you have to have this native API, and you have to have a bunch of OS-specific code. I could have built an abstract API for rendering text in Kyra, but that doesn't seem like our job, and Pango already existed for Linux, and Qt has its own layout engine now. So Qt and Pango should both be able to use this mechanism in Kyra quite nicely. Again, all the text APIs come in two kinds. You have the real API that works in glyph indices, because as we all know, Unicode to glyph mapping is not one-to-one. If you're painting, the obvious example is if you're painting a character with an accent in it and there's no native Unicode representation for the glyph with the accent, then you need to get two glyphs. Then you have to take those two Unicode code points and map them to a single glyph, because often the font will have a pre-composed version. And contrary-wise, if you have a font that only has the decomposed letters and accents, and you have a pre-composed Unicode value that has an E with a little accent on it, the font system has to go and say, well, how do I draw an E with an accent? Oh, you draw the E, and then you draw the accent. So then we have one Unicode code point, two glyphs, and the other way as well. So Pango only wants to work in glyphs because it needs to lay them out, and the OpenType tables tell you where to move things, and they've got all these. I think it's Turing complete. I'm not kidding. It's OpenType's a scary spec. I didn't want to deal with it, and Owen seemed very happy to deal with it in Pango, and Matthias seemed very happy to deal with it in Qt, and was like, cool, you guys go off and deal with that part. Let me know what glyphs you want and where you want them on the screen. So it's all pretty simple. Again, the OS-specific code has to figure out how to grub through the font and map Unicode values to sequences of glyphs. That's what they wanted. Now, the requirement here was that Kyra applications match non-Kyra applications on the same screen. That seemed more important to them than to have Kyra applications on my screen match Kyra applications on his screen, because we're looking at screens at the same time. Here's the toy text API, font weight and slant, OS independent. So you can actually write OS independent code if you want to. It just isn't very useful. And the only text representation is UTF-8, because that's the right one. And we can talk about that out back later. It has extends functions. Now the thing is, the only thing that's toy about this API is the the font selection and the code which maps from Unicode values to glyphs. Everything else is the same. You can still convert the text to paths. You can still do all your transformation matrices. You can still fill them with patterns. The only thing that's toy is kind of this front-end stuff. All the back-end stuff is all the same. So you can do all the weird examples. Here's a pretty simple example. It selects a font. I asked for whatever family you thought was reasonable, the null family. And then I wanted a normal font. It was normal slant, well, not slanty and not bold. I scaled it to 72 in the, remember, these aren't points anymore. These are the default transformation matrix. And so that's about 72 pixels to follow on this screen. Set it to black, moved to some coordinate, and painted the text. Now, the origin, of course, of the text is not up here. The origin of the text is down there. So you always end up getting big Y values to get stuff into your image. Otherwise, it draws off the top, and you see nothing. Actually, for this example, you see the bottom of the comma here, and you see one pixel from each O. And I can tell you this because the first time I drew the text, that's what I saw. I said, oh, crap, that's right. Transformed out. Pretty simple. We could also get the extensive text. The toy API, again, takes UTF-8 strings. You can also pass it a list of glyphs. It gives you the X and Y bearing, which is the location in the upper left-hand corner of the rectangle, the width and height of the rectangle, and the spacing from the origin to where you should draw the next string by default. All these are measured in user space, so we have to take the coordinates, take the current coordinate, hand it to the transformation matrix, blah, 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 go through all the font information, then transform it all back. So, yeah, we do a lot of matrix math. That's why you have a floating point unit. Measured in user space. And here's a text extends example. Pretty simple. In this case, I'm going to draw the text, and I'm going to draw a box around it. And as you can see, the box is drawn precisely around the glyphs. There isn't any space or anything. So the glyph metrics are very accurate. Pretty simple. And I drew it again with a lovely red color. I'm not sure that the signs of all these things are right, but that's how they're working today. I'm going to have to think about whether I like those or not. Always odd. The first time I did this, I assumed it was using the X definition for ascent. I subtracted here, and the rectangle went off the bottom. So I'll have to talk to Carl whether the signs are all right, because signs and text stuff are always hard. Okay. And you can also convert text to paths. We can convert either, again, UTF-8 or sequence of glyphs to a path. We use the native font outlines. That means that I use the native font library to get the outlines of the glyphs. So if you're using FreeType, I'm not extracting the spline and line data from the raw glyph. I'm actually going in the post-hinted version. So I really do get precisely the outline that you would have painted if you painted the glyph on the screen. That appends it to the current path. You get as many glyphs as you want in the current path. And unlike PostScript, you can actually go and look through the path and grab out the data. PostScript has these cool restrictions so that in case you have a copyrighted font, you can't see the outlines. Well, we don't support that. But actually, the reason is not because we're against copyright or trademark issues, but because when PostScript was designed, that was actually a realistic concern. People were concerned that they were going to go get outlines and get the fonts. And because you could embed the font in a printer, you could actually ascertain that nobody could get the outline by having the language restrict you in this way. There was no way to get the outline back up the wire. And that's why PostScript has these limitations. But because fonts are all inside your computer now, there's no restriction possible. Unless you DMCA them or something. But fonts are all pre-DMCA, so all the APIs allow you to get up the outline. Very nice. And look, it actually worked. This worked the first time. I was very excited. I tried this before this morning at about 8 o'clock. This is a new slide. Again, select the font, scale it, set the color, convert it to a path, and stroke it so you get a lovely outline. Okay, now one of the interesting parts of Kairos, how does error handle? C doesn't have any exceptions, as you know. You can't have an error get you out of your current function and get you all the way back to the top level so you can print a nice message without having to have an error return check on every function. Checking every return, a function return value from every function is really tedious, and it completely obscures the meaning of the code. As a result, C programmers rarely bother. I don't know how many of you have seen closed functions check error returns, but I rarely do. The result is that there's lots of programs that don't check error values, and the errors go undetected. And so your program goes merrily along, charging through error conditions and crashing miserably. Okay, so how do we fix this in a C API? Cairo error handling, they all return status. You could check them if you wanted to. But the status is persistent. So once there's been an error in the API, you can't recover from that. You can ask at any time whether an error has occurred on this object. The persistence here is not global. It's for each one of those little Cairo T objects you've seen throughout the API here. I have an example. Come on. This is really slow. This Cairo T object, that's where the status lives. So when an error occurs, the API shuts down, stops doing anything. That means that every API has a well-defined behavior when an error has occurred. Stroke does nothing, fill does nothing, your graphic state is completely destroyed, nothing happens. But that means you can keep calling as many functions as you want for as long as you like, and all the behavior of the system is well-defined. Nothing bad will happen. It won't crash. But you won't get any output either. It actually works out pretty well, because people tend to notice when you don't get any output. Yep. What? Yeah. Right, SQL has the advantage of having actual transactions. We don't have that. It would be nice if there was some way, if there would be some way that you could kind of restore your graphics context and get back to a non-error state and go again and try the operation again. But unfortunately, because there isn't any transactional notion in the object, except for the object itself, you get an error in a save, graphic save. What do you do? I don't know. You can't do a restore. You had an error in the save. So there's no obvious way to get back to a known state with the object. Once an error has occurred, the object is useless. Okay, so here's an obvious error example. I do a translate, I draw the basket, and I do a restore. Whoa, where's my save? Well, I forgot the save. That was an error. And so I ask it, was there an error in the sequence of operations up above? Even though I've drawn the basket again. Here, I'm going to draw the basket again after I did this erroneous operation. And Cairo says, oh, yes, there was an error at some point. You forgot to do a restore without a matching save. Cairo printed out a nice error. So that's persistent. Well, that means that you often don't have any idea where in the hell your code actually generated the error. So you run it on the debugger, you set a breakpoint in the error function that sets the error, and that solves the problem. What? Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. Yes, you can check the status as often as you like. How could it get the error line and file? Everything into a macro. Thank you, Rusty. I kiss. What? Yeah, bucket, please. Oh, yeah. Monsieur needs a bucket. Yeah, so we didn't do that. Okay, now somebody asked earlier. So actually I got some positive feedback on that particular error mechanism, because it means that when you do have an error, you get nothing on the screen. And that's usually pretty noticeable. It's a lot more noticeable than, oh, that tiny little circle on the clock didn't draw. Now, why is that? It looks kind of weird. It's kind of broken. Oh, there was an error that was unchecked. Instead, you get blankness. Blankness is a lot more noticeable. And the other thing, again, is that the Cairo API is well-defined. All the behavior of the API is well-defined after any error. You can keep calling it, and nothing will appear on the screen. And so the only thing you can usefully do with this object is get its status, find out that an error occurred, and destroy it. And then you create another one and you try again. Yeah?
Do you have like clones?
Yes. Yeah, you can clone them. But after they're broken, you don't get a useful one. Yep. Yeah, you could clone it. Yep. Does it? Cool. Who checks? Exactly. Well, and the other thing is, yeah, you had a question? No, there are no callbacks in Cairo by design. We want to be able to make the library right now is fully reentrant because it's trivial if you don't have any callbacks and you have a global state object that you're passing in. With callbacks, all of a sudden threading becomes very hard. We're trying to avoid it. The other thing is that it isn't, you know, you could get a callback, but what do you do? Well, oh, I got an error. What? This is just as effective. At the end of the operation, you say, did an error occur? Oh, an error occurred. Put up a dialog. You can check the status whenever you like. So the usual thing is to check the status. You draw your figure, you check the status, oh, it didn't work. You put up an error dialog. So, and you know, when you're doing program development, obviously, it would be nicer if the error was more closely aligned so you could actually figure out when you've made an error. And you can do that just by setting a breakpoint in the Cairo library when an error occurs. And then when you're actually deploying the program, ostensibly there aren't any more static errors left in the application. The only errors are system-dependent ones. And so, you know, that should be kind of up at the higher levels and down at the lower levels. The other nice thing is that it doesn't, it works very nicely with most modern languages and modern processors that really don't like precise exception handling. Because modern processors really hate being demanded to do precise exception handling. So having a model where the exception is kind of sticky and it hangs around, you eventually go get the status, means that on a modern processor, you don't have to try to deal with all the C++ or Java exception nightmares, which are evil. Okay, so the insides of Cairo. Oh, no. See, first time I gave this talk, we were on a boat, so the boat seemed very appropriate. No boat this time. Very sad. Okay, so some of the interesting technology in Cairo is how we draw splines. You'd think after, I don't know, 50 years, ever since de Castelgeau invented Bezier splines, but didn't get credit. Remember, publish. You'd think in the last 50 years somebody would figure out how to stroke splines. Well, it took until about 1985 for somebody to figure out how to stroke splines. Splines are stroked by doing a Minkowski sum, and we're approximating the Minkowski sum by convolution. And I'll show you how both those work. The first thing that you do to stroke a spline is you convert the spline into line segments. De Castelgeau has this beautiful little algorithm. It takes no floating point computations. You can do it with our fixed point coordinates with adds and shifts. It's very nice. Decompose the spline into line segments. Again, our pens are explicitly defined to be approximated with polygons. The reason that you want to convert all of these quadratic and cubic functions into linear functions is that the combination of linear functions is always linear, and the combination of polynomial functions is nasty, ugly polynomials. The X specification has a quadratic specification for arcs. They're specified as ellipses. And a quadratic specification for pens are specified as circles. And the combination of those two is a lovely eighth-order polynomial, specifying the outline of your wide ellipse. That's approximated in the X server with some lovely iterative algorithms that use a Newton's method to find the solution to that at every scan line. Three times. It's kind of slow. What? Yeah, really slow. Really ugly. So You know, you learn, you go talk to the computation geometers and you say, well, what do we do? And they say, make everything linear. How do we make it accurate? Specify your accuracy. Use lots of short lines. They're not that expensive. So we compute really, our Beziers turn into a lot of tiny little lines. And our pens turn into lots of little tiny lines. But that's okay, because it's all linear stuff. So we're still not talking about any kind of quadratic algorithms or anything like that. It's linear. Linear is fine. CPUs are really fast at doing linear stuff, as long as it doesn't explode on you. Let's see. And so we have an ellipse that's approximately the polygon. And then we fill the result. We thought for a while that we were going to be able to come up with an ON algorithm to tessellate the, take this outline of the, to take this stroke spline and convert it into trapezoids. We still haven't got an implementation that works reliably. So we're still using a quadratic algorithm that basically computes a polygon that's the hull of the convolution, and we just fill the polygon, which isn't ideal. The other thing that we haven't come up with a solution to right now is called the evolute. If you've ever seen a wide, I don't know if I have an example. We'll see if I have an example here. Okay, so what is a Minkowski sum? A Minkowski sum is a very simple geometric notion. You have two sets, set A and set B, and the Minkowski sum is the set of all combinations of all the elements in the set. Right? So you take point A, a point in A and a point in B, add them together, do that for all the points in the set. It's basically the formal model for stroking with a pen. You take your stroke, which is a set of points along the stroke, and your pen, which is a lovely disk, and you do a you do this Minkowski sum, and you get this lovely stroked figure. Pretty simple. Simple notionally. Here's a de Cachel-Zhou algorithm. It's a really simple way of drawing a spline. Here's the spline specified with this green line. It's got 4 points, one here, one there, and then two here. This was obviously drawn with Cairo, so you can see the translucency going on, so you can actually see the color distinct colors. I was very proud. I drew this myself. And again, you can see that the spline is contained in the hull of these 4 points. So if you draw a convex hull around these 4 points that specify the spline, every point on the spline is in that hull. That's one of the nice advantages of the Bezier specification for splines. Again, the Bezier specification, you give a point that's the initial point of the spline, and that this point here specifies a tangent at that point. And this point here specifies a tangent at that point. And then the line is defined with this cubic functions. Pretty simple. But the nice thing about the Cachel-Zhou algorithm, you just take these 4 points and you can decompose this big spline into a littler spline, into two littler splines. So you just do this simple math where you this is just the average of these 2 points. This is the average of these 2 points here. This is the average of these 2 points. This is the average of these 2 points. This is the average of these 2 points, and that's the average of those 2 points. This point is on the spline. This line is tangent to the spline. This line is tangent to the spline. So this big spline, all the way from here to here, is composed of these two littler cubic splines, one from here and one from here. I've got the specification for those points. All I had to do was add and shift, and now I've decomposed. Now the nice thing is I've got these lines, right, and they are an approximation to the spline. Well, how far are they? I can compute the distance from this point to the spline really easily. Is it close enough? Is it within my tolerance yet? Well, no, not quite yet. Wash, rinse, and repeat, decompose those, and now with adds and shifts, I can decompose the spline into lines. It's a well-known algorithm. Everybody uses it. I thought it was cool. Interesting thing is how I learned about this algorithm. So I was talking with a friend of mine in Palo Alto, Lyle Ramshaw, and I said, okay, so how do we draw Bezier splines? He said, oh, let me tell you. And so on the phone, he says, stand in front of the whiteboard, draw these dots, draw the curve, draw these lines. Here's how you do it. It's like, okay, I'm listening, drawing, drawing, drawing. Oh, cool. So he explained over the telephone with me doing the drawing how to do this algorithm. I was like, wow, I wish I could teach like that.
You just said you had a couple of like,
Yeah, see, I could have done this over the phone. That was, yeah. So the other thing I learned about Lyle Ramshaw is that we had been starting to look at algorithms for how to do all this stuff in Cairo and doing a bunch of research. And we kept looking at papers that were referring to this Guibus et al. Paper from the mid-1980s. It's like, okay, Guibus et al. Can we get a copy of this? Well, no, it's pre-internet. So it's available only in paper form. So I go off to the library and get a copy of Guibus et al., because that was the only reference we'd seen. It was actually Guibus Ramshaw and a few other names. Ramshaw was the professor, Guibus was his student. So basically, the entire field of computational geometry and 2D graphics devolves back to this paper, and I was working with the guy who wrote the paper. So I was like, whoa. Not only is he really good at this stuff, he practically invented it, which is kind of a neat thing to... And he's a really nice guy. So we can polygonal pens, again, really simple notion. You want to take an elliptical pen and approximate it with a polygon. Not too hard. You compute this little function. It tells you how many lines you need to approximate the pen to within the flat space. Pretty simple. The other thing that we do, remember our funky Bezier here. I want to be able to draw a flat end that's precisely the width of the pen. And so what I do for my polygon is I add two points in the polygon at the ends where the spline is going to end. So I add these little points here so that the end of the spline is exactly the width of the pen, so that the joins all work up nicely. There's no bumpiness. So I get a polygon with about 50 points in it, and then I add two for the start and two for the end. So I get 54 points in my pen. That works pretty well. And now we're going to take our tessellated spline, which has been approximated by a sequence of line segments, and our pen, which has been approximated by a polygon, and we're going to approximate the Minkowski sum with a convolution. And this convolution operation is relatively straightforward. It does not compute the points of the interior of the line. It only computes the boundary. It computes the hull of the figure. And essentially what you do is you place the pen at each vertex here, and you draw lines, the appropriate vertex. So you, and this is our algorithm, it's pretty novel. Carr and I came up with this. Basically the operations are all local. As you're stepping from one point to the next along the boundary of the ellipse on the outside here, you either step along the pen to the next point in the pen, or you step along the path. And it depends upon which one is going to keep you on the hull of the figure. So which one is rotationally further out. So here we can see that the path goes this way and the pen goes this way. So the pen is closer to our current path than to our current direction than the path is. So we step along the pen here. And again, the next time up here, we find that the pen, stepping along the pen, keeps us outside of the path. And so we step along the pen. Now we get to here, and we note that stepping along the pen is going to be inside of stepping along the path. So we step along the path. And here, we do the same thing. We notice that the pen is inside the path. We step along the path. So essentially what we have here is we have a piecewise combination of the path in spots and the pen in spots. And if you can see the blue, you can actually see it pretty well. You can see which pieces are made up of bits of the pen and which pieces are made up of bits of the path. The nice thing here is that because the pen is within our flatness, not that this is very flat, but that's the idea, and the path is within our flatness, I know that the combined figure here is within the flatness, the specified flatness. Because both of those were within the flatness as well. So I know the combination is within the flatness. And that's kind of a cool result. That means that I can do this in linear time. There's no quadratic element to this computation at all, because it's all local computations. It's a constant operation per vertex. Very nice. Okay, so how does it work? Well, it turns out it works pretty good. Here's what GoScript draws with this lovely spline. I didn't draw what Libart drew. Libart crashed. I had a hard time capturing its output. But GhostScript drew something. It just drew something ugly. And of course, Cairo draws beautiful. So that's the result. You can see here, this is mostly, although not entirely, the path. And this round piece right here is almost entirely the pen. Because it gets up to the top here, and it's going to turn really fast. And so it ends up using the pen all the way around, and then goes back down the other side. Oh, way more than that. The flatness here is 0.1 of a pixel, and so it probably has, oh, I don't know, 1,000 line segments to that spline. Who knows? Lots. What? The nice thing is it's linear in the number of points here. So if I lower my flatness, I get a linear. By increasing my flatness, it's a linear cost. It's not a quadratic cost. So if I get a flatness from 0.1 to 0.10, from 0.1 to 0.01, it's 10 times slower. It's not 100 times slower. So that's a nice scaling factor. And 0.1 of a pixel, we can draw splines like this at 600 dpi with 0.1 of a pixel on a full-size sheet of paper in reasonable time. So it's fast enough. Okay. What time has it gotten to be? 105. We're going to 1:30, right? Okay. So Cairo is a new 2D API for rendering. The output is device independent, but it's not OS independent. But that means on a single OS, your output looks the same everywhere, but across OSs, you've got this font problem. That obviously is a compromise we didn't really like making, but the reality was is that the applications required consistent fonts between applications on the same platform. Several major projects are interested. A few have gone further than others. The Mono project is probably the furthest along right now because Miguel's a crazy man. And they don't really have any choice. They have to do all of GDI plus, and only Cairo can give them GDI plus on X. Mozilla is interested. I haven't seen any big announcements about development starting. GTK plus, I've got some examples I can show you where GTK plus is working with Cairo quite nicely. And the KDE project, one of the nice things about Qt is all of its rendering is completely abstract. So the KDE applications that use the Qt rendering will be able to just replace the Qt rendering with a Cairo-based implementation of it. And KDE applications will all look very nice. Let's see, what's next? And here's everybody who helped me. Carl Wirth, who's not here and should be, he actually wrote most of Cairo. I just got to specify it. That's the best part. Obviously, Owen Taylor and Chris Blizzard. Owen Taylor works on Pango. Chris Blizzard works on Mozilla. They were instrumental in forcing me to get rid of the OS independence of the output. Lyle Ramshaw, who is the researcher at HP Labs, who understands 2D graphics better than I do. Surya Kulor, I believe he did the first Java binding. And there's lots of other people. I don't remember what Julian Boulanois did. He did the new font APIs. And lots of other people. So we actually have a nearly credible open source project. There's more than one developer. I think we fall out of these canonical SourceForge projects. Here's where it's available. Again, note the lovely Cairo lowercase. Appropriate selection of fonts. This is Vera Sans Bold. It's a good choice. Yeah, we're font geeks. I wanted to show you a few applications, and we have some time. How this stuff works. Actually working here. What? You gotta have demos. broken.
That
must be a demo, yeah. That's a bummer. What did I do with that? Oh, I know what I did with that. I don't think I updated that language yet. Oh, never mind. What was I going to do? You showed you the clock? And this is a little SVG viewer application. It gives you an idea of how fast it's rendering these days. I'm just scaling it up and down. I can rotate it, I think. Translate it back and forth. Now if I actually turn on Compositing Manager, I can actually do this translucently as well. One of the nice things about Cairo, of course, is that it can render it can output anti-alias graphics. And so you actually see here, Cairo has an alpha channel everywhere, and so it can actually render that alpha channel all the way through to the X server. And so the X server can take advantage of that alpha channel, and you note that the X server can even draw a shadow that exactly follows the figure. That shadow is not drawn by XSVG. Shadow is actually drawn by the X server using the alpha channel of the figure. This also lets you see where the SVGs are kind of broken. A lot of SVGs assume they're going to be drawn over white. And so you'll notice things like, oops, that's not supposed to be filled in. That's kind of fun. Let's see. Convolution not yet. There's another example of a larger SVG that uses a lot of color and has translucency. And you can see it's not very fast. And unfortunately, I hope that's mostly just the speed of the render extension right now, and I hope it's going to get a lot faster. But getting one of the issues that we have in the render extension right now is trapezoids. It turns out that you would think drawing a trapezoid would be... I tried to make it as dumb as possible. What's the stupidest thing I can possibly draw? Oh, I know. I'll pick trapezoids. How hard can those be? Well, turns out they're really hard. I'm glad I didn't try anything harder. We spent about 6 months trying to specify trapezoids, and we came up with what we thought was a specification for them and implemented it and almost got it working and discovered that it was horribly broken. And then I went back and did an informal proof that proved you could never make that implementation work. Back to the drawing board. And so that implementation was kind of interesting. The specification was kind of interesting. The question is, when you're drawing anti-aliased figures and you're partially covering a pixel, what is the alpha value for the polygon over that pixel? That's a very interesting question. The obvious answer, and the answer that comes up instantly, is, oh, you take the area, and that's the fraction of alpha values that you use. Well, you have to round it, because alpha values are an integer number, but you want to make sure that you don't round it too low. So in other words, if I tessellate, I've got 256 possible alpha values in an 8-bit alpha. If I draw a million polygons that cover that one pixel, as some applications do, almost all of those polygons will have alpha of 0. But if they really do cover the pixel, you want to make sure that there's some of those polygons have non-zero alpha, so that eventually it adds up to 255. And that means that there are some blessed polygons in that figure that have non-zero alpha, even though their area is approximately 0. A million polygons, only 255 alpha values. If each of those is a millionth of a pixel, then you round them, you get 0. You add up a million zeros, and you always get 0. So what we thought we could do is we came up with this really hokey specification that would say, okay, you take the polygon that you just rendered, and you pretend that it's that it the polygon, say the polygon is like this shaped in the middle of the pixel. You pretend that it's only like this, and it covers the whole pixel, the up and left of the polygon. And then you take that alpha value, and then take the other edge of the polygon, and compute that alpha value, and subtract. Okay. If you do this with an easy, obvious tessellation, 255 of those polygons are going to get non-zero alpha. Cool. Automatically figured out exactly which ones could work, and you'd get good results in all cases. Well, unfortunately, some of the times you end up getting negative alpha values. Those are bad. And because if you have a little square in the middle of the pixel, you got a little square in the middle of the pixel,